able to have a lesson during this period from Jacob Hudgens. And the week before, had a lesson from David Smitherman. Thank you for covering on that, David. Appreciate it. And here we are. Now we're back to Brand X. So hope you all enjoy the study this morning. We are our previous lesson on Exodus 3 weeks ago covered the laws concerning slaves. We discussed the rightness, wrongness of slavery, whether God condoned it, allowed it, approved of it. And then we talked about making restitution for wrongdoings, the common law, if you will, that was set up through the law of Moses to take care of disputes between people, various behavioral statutes, Sabbaths, other observances, God's promise of victory for the people when they went into the land of Canaan. And then we saw the blood of the covenant that was introduced by Moses as he introduced God's covenant with Israel. And then the call of Moses up onto the mountain where he's going to receive the law and God's instructions concerning the building of the tabernacle. Now, this week we should be in very heavily with the building of that tabernacle, but first we're going to talk about a little more guidance on the Sabbath and talk about the golden calf. That's one of the uglier episodes of this book. Then the tent of meeting, and then Moses talking with God once again, and the rewriting of those tablets. God renewing his covenant with Israel after reissuing his law, and Moses' face reflecting God's glory when he comes down off of the mountain, so much so he had to cover it up. And then the work commencing on the tabernacle. In fact, we'll try to get beyond that if we can. What I would like to do is get as close to the end of Exodus today as possible, if not even reach that end. I don't think that'll quite happen, but then be able to finish it up next week and then get right on into some what I would call capstone issues with Exodus. Talk some about more of the overriding lessons we have nowadays from the book of Exodus, how understanding the book of Exodus can enhance our study of the rest of the Bible, and a little bit of the archaeological aspects of the Exodus and the pathway that Israel took to Canaan. So, apologize for the slides not working. I don't know what happened. We may be on different editions of PowerPoint. I don't know what it was. I copied it onto four different sources and brought them in. All four of them don't work. So we'll see what that is. I don't know what that's all about. But here we're going to start out on Exodus 31, verses 12 through, pardon my eyes, too. 12 through several verses later. So why is God so adamant about observing the Sabbath? Anyone care to offer an idea why God sees the Sabbath as such an important observance for the people of Israel? We all remember how the Sabbath, what the source of the Sabbath is. Of course, God took 6 days to create the heavens and the earth and man, and on the seventh day he rested. But verse 13 says, "For it is a sign between him and Israel, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." So reminders, as in the observances of the unleavened bread, observance of the Passover, the reminders are there as part of the observance. I am the Lord your God who sanctifies you, makes you holy, sets you apart from everyone else. That is what he wants to convey with the Sabbath. And he has some very strict rules concerning the Sabbath. And he says that whoever profanes that Sabbath is going to undergo a severe punishment. And it's death and a separation are prescribed in that. And that's in verse 14. There's punishment of death. There's punishment of cutting off. My question is, and hopefully there's someone here that can answer it definitively, are those the same thing? Is that the same punishment? Is it the death as in Genesis 2:17, when God said in the day that you eat from it, being the tree, the day that you eat from it, you will surely die. But it was not a physical death that day. Death was brought in, but they were not punished with a physical death, but with a separation from God. Is this, when he mentions both death and a banishment from the people of Israel, kicking you out of the camp, basically, for good, are those the same? Is that death a figurative death of separation between the offender and Israel? Any thoughts along those lines? Yes.
Of body and spirit, physical life is a union of body and spirit, and this separation can be used and looked set forth as death. And I think what you said is that's the point. That was the death. That's separation from God.
Okay, and I think that's a very likely possibility. I'll tell you what I think about this. And we can maybe discuss it a little bit, or take it for what it's worth. It's just an opinion from Ed Witt, without any power behind it whatsoever, other than the power of my little gray cells up between my ears. I think it's a spectrum of punishment, and we've already seen where Moses has set up these multi-level judges throughout Israel, people to judge at different levels, different problems, and the most severe come to Moses for judgment. I believe that this is setting up a spectrum. It's like getting 5 to life, or actually I don't know of anything as 5 to life, maybe 20 years to life for second-degree murder. You profane the Sabbath, you may be cut off from your people, you may suffer death. But these are punishments for profaning the Sabbath. And the judge is going to decide, depending on the severity of your offense, but at the very best, you're going to be cut off from Israel. At the worst, you're going to be executed. You're going to be stoned to death, or however they dictate that death shall occur. Again, Ed's opinion. It could very well be, and good arguments to say that is a one and the same. They're kicked out of the camp for good, and that is a figurative death, a separation of that person from God, a spiritual death. They are no longer one of the people. So it's one or the other, but either one is quite severe. Larry?
Someone being stoned to death for violating the Sabbath?
Do you know of any?
I forgot to bring my phone with me. I don't have my Bible.
I remember when the disciples were criticized for just taking the ears off the wheat and eating them on a Sabbath, that was work. But no one suggested stoning the disciples for that. Jesus healing the blind man on the Sabbath, but no one proposed stoning him to death for that, or even kicking him out of the city for it. So I don't know. Maybe at that point in time, punishments for profaning the Sabbath had become so lax as to be almost forgotten. We don't punish anymore. We only punish adultery when someone's caught in the act. Take the one person. Last I knew, adultery took 2 people to occur, but the one person was being taken out to be stoned. Anyhow, I don't know right offhand of someone having been put to death for profaning the Sabbath in Scripture. But I don't doubt that at some point it happened. Yes, sir.
In Numbers 15, verse 32, there's a man found gathering firewood. And this is right after they received this law, and they take it to Moses, and the ruling is that he's stoned, and they take him out and stone him.
Okay, thank you for that. That's there we have it, Larry, an example of that punishment being imposed on a person. And as Josh said, is just right after this law was made, and apparently the severity was issued to be in compliance for one thing, but also to drive home the point to everyone, this is what can happen if you profane the Sabbath. So now God finishes this conversation with Moses, and he gives Moses the tablets of stone. That tablet of stone has got the law. Those tablets of stone have the law written on them, front and back, written by the finger of God. So now we move on to chapter 32, the first four verses. We're going to talk about the first commandment being violated. First commandments. Make that a plural. At this point, Moses seems to be missing in action to some people. Now, never mind that the mountain's still up there, the great big pillar of cloud is still there, the place is shaking. You've got the rules that no one can come close, and not even livestock, or they'll be put to death. But they don't see Moses, and they don't see him for quite a while. The people want a God. They reject the God whose cloud is on the mountain within their sight, and they demand that Aaron make him one. And Aaron says, what's he telling them to do? He tells them to tear off your earrings. Depending on which translation you look at, is either tear off, break off, or pull off, or break, take them apart. I checked the Hebrew word, and of course, I can look and see how the word can be translated, but I don't know how the word is applied. I don't have that depth of knowledge in ancient Greek or Hebrew. So I couldn't tell you which one is most proper, but I can tell you it means take one thing away from another. So we break it apart, tear it apart, remove it. So the first time I ever read that, I thought, whoa, they're going to tear their earrings off. And I knew about women piercing their ears and putting earrings in there. The idea of tearing it off, that really hurts just thinking about it. But I don't think that's what Aaron meant when he said, tear off your earrings and make this that painful a process. But it was a painful process, what came about. So why a calf? Why did they have to have a calf for their God?
Significant religious figure. There was this special cow that they or bull that they would just baby and just took so much care of it. They had special burial places for it, and that may be a carryover from that.
And in fact, we remember back when we're talking about Pharaoh telling them, okay, you stay where you are and you make your sacrifices. And Moses said, we can't do that, because we're going to profane your sacrifices, your religion, your false gods, by taking the symbol of your false god and sacrificing it. We sacrifice bulls as one of our sacrifices, and you people worship the things. Wouldn't be proper. So here we have that same animal, and he's what's formed from the gold that they put together from everyone's earrings. Also, another possibility, and it could just add to that, it was also a popular god for the region they were about to occupy. It, in that region of the world, it has been a long-standing thing for people of nomadic nature who decide to move into a place and occupy to also adopt the local gods. And this was also a local god there. In fact, Baal was a very popular false god throughout the Mediterranean and as well as in the Middle East. It was normal. It happened a lot. when my first time on the island of Crete, it was back in military days, we went down there to stage over into Turkey. But while we were there, Greece and Turkey started mobilizing to go to war with each other. So I got to spend about a five-day paid vacation in Crete, which was kind of nice. We got in a car, went down to Heraklion, the other end of the island from Souda Bay, where we were basing. And there's a big temple there that's been excavated. It's a temple to a bull. So the Greeks and their predecessors had put this together. Greeks maintained it for a long time. But it's yet another one of the false gods that comes from a bull. This bull was seen to be something that provided life, longevity, fruitfulness. You want a cow to have a calf, you bring the bull in, and sooner or later you are presented with a calf. So it is something that was normal. Going into a new land, adopt the local gods, or you take the gods from the land you came from, or you see that both of them had that, why not us? But here they were. They had this calf, and they made the calf at Horeb, and they worshipped it. And we see in Psalms chapter 106, the psalmist writing about that, and many of the other things that the Hebrews did, the Israelites did over their years. But in this case, in verses 19 and 20, the psalmist writes, they made a calf in Horeb and worshipped a molten image. Thus they exchanged their glory for the image of an ox that eats grass. How smart is that? It's hard to lose the irony of that statement in Psalms. An ox that eats grass. By rejecting God, they who are made in His image reject the glory of that image. And they went after the tarnishment of a piece of metal. In Romans chapter 1, passage we're pretty well familiar with, beginning verse 22, Paul writes, professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of an incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. It was a false god, it was a piece of metal, and it was the image of something that ate grass. But here they were, worshiping this thing, and you got to wonder what motivated them to do this. What are some of the possibilities? Anyone have any ideas of why people would just, in the absence of Moses, decide, okay, let's build something and worship it? Got to be some ideas about that, I would think. But what's the guy say whoever this they is that talked to Aaron? What did he say about Moses? As for this Moses, we don't know where he is. He's the one that brought us up, not led us up, but brought us up from Egypt. And you might put in there a parenthetical thing, and we didn't want to do that. Ed?
What they were doing in Egypt, or what they saw others doing in Egypt, and they were just influenced by that culture, and just referring back to it.
Going back kind of to the roots, or the roots that stood around them.
Yeah.
And it happened so soon, too. You kind of wonder, have they yet come to love and trust God, the one who really led them out of Egypt, who did all these things to Pharaoh, who provided them water and food in a desert region for over 1 million people. Quite an accomplishment. If you have all the resources of the earth behind you and a logistical train with you, and you try to base 1 million people or more out in the middle of a desert, military we used to call it bear basing, very difficult thing to do, and it takes a lot of work, a lot of support. 1 million people would be considered almost impossible event. God did it just because he said that it would be done. How about Aaron's acquiescence? Is Aaron showing himself to be a leader here? I think he kind of failed on that mark. The first time they asked, he just, oh, okay, let's do it, and here's how we're going to do it. He led in the wrong direction. He did do some leading. He got them to take their earrings and throw them into the fire. But he offered no leadership towards God, no leadership for God, no leadership that would better his people. And in doing what he did, he certainly did not better his people, but he led them, many of them, to their deaths, both physical and spiritual. His lack of faith in God and in his promises said that they didn't understand that there was something better in store for them. What is the book of Hebrews about? I heard it. Say it. Something better. Someone better. A better priesthood. A better covenant. Everything better. The promise of better that's given to us through Christ. We need to make sure that we don't lose sight of that better for our lives, for our souls, for our eternity, as they lost sight of the better that God offered them on their way to the promised land. Yes?
Make a God who would go before them from that point forward. And it troubles me more what Aaron said, where he said, this is your God after he fashioned it, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. You know, Aaron even took it back from when they were, you know, training the Egyptians.
Right.
They wanted something from that point forward, and it shows how far he had actually gone.
Right, and that was the ultimate insult against God. Just saying that this image, metallic image of a thing that eats grass, is what brought you out of image, what out of Egypt, what defeated Pharaoh. Ed?
And Israel, the king, later on, the king in First Kings 12, the king made two calves of gold and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here is your gods, O Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." So that was Dan and Bethel. Two calves of gold. And the same thing was said about those two calves that's brought you up out of the land of Egypt.
Yeah. And this was offered as a convenience. He was hoping that the people in the northern kingdom of Israel would say, yeah, okay, Jerusalem's too far to go. We'll just go to these two temples that he has set up, and we'll worship these calves there. Again, the same insult hurled at God, that this image of a thing that eats grass is what brought us out of Egypt, what did all of those miracles. I have another, J.D.?
Slimy to me, the compromise that Aaron makes, in that he says, he makes this idol, but then he says in verse 5, tomorrow shall be a feast to Jehovah. And what it seems to me is not so much that Aaron has completely given up who Jehovah is, but he's trying to have both. And that's what's happening in Hebrews 2, is bringing in some of the old and trying to get all the benefits of the new. And so what it tells me is he knows better. He knows they should be worshiping Jehovah, but he's not strong enough to oppose and goes along with and even gets caught up in all of this compromise of, well, this is Jehovah.
Absolutely, he knows better. Otherwise, when his little brother showed up, he wouldn't have said, please don't be angry with me. The people said they wanted a god, and they made me put all this stuff in the fire, and out jumped this calf. How stupid did he think Moses was? I guess as a carryover from when they were little guys, when his little brother would believe absolutely anything. But that I think, shows very well, like just what you said, that Aaron knew better. He knew this wasn't the way to go. But he was just kind of struggling along there without the backbone to resist it. Yes?
Verse 1, like you mentioned, people say Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And then when they make the image and everything, it's interesting to me that in verse 4, you know, like we've been talking about, Aaron says this is your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So like Jesus was saying, I think Aaron knows better, and I wonder here if he's compromising a little bit, like trying to, and again, right after he says that, then, you know, there's a feast to the Lord. So I wonder if Aaron was trying to compromise and do what the people wanted and still point to God. Like, is this to Aaron just a physical image, like representation of the God that brought them out of the land of Egypt? But either way, you know, we know that was wrong. But I don't know, it's just interesting to me that it does seem like Aaron is just trying to compromise, and it doesn't work that way. But
right, and there are a lot who, a lot of commentators and such, scholars who surmise that that is the path Aaron was trying to take, trying to kind of in a way show them the folly of their ways, but without directing them away from those follies. And we see that again in the lie that he tells Moses, but also we see that when the scripture says that Moses saw that the people were unrestrained because Aaron made them that way, he caused them to be unrestrained so that they looked shameful in front of their enemies. Some translations say that rather than unrestrained, they were naked. Again, I checked on the word, and the word is uncovered or out of control. So it's left a little up in the air as to which it is. I tend to think it means uncovered, unclothed, naked. But he was he had put them up for shame in allowing them to do that, and that shame being in front of their enemies. Nevertheless, it was a compromise. Was it not? What did that compromise get them? It got them all of the sons of Levi taking up the sword and going through and cutting down the most serious offenders in this case. We don't have a count or anything like that, but obviously many Israelites died that day because of Aaron's failure to provide proper leadership and for their desires to go after a false god. Anything more on the golden calf and what we have there? Well, that episode happened, and the following portions of the lesson this morning talk a little bit more about that. I'll probably skip over a little bit of it because in our conversation we've already covered some of it, but when Moses was still on the mountain with God, and this was going on, God tells him what's happening. He heads on down the mountainside, took up the tablets with him, comes across Joshua. Joshua thinks it's the sound of war. Moses tells him, no, I don't hear triumph. I don't hear defeat. This is the sound of people playing. He saw the people out of control. Some translations say naked. It could mean cover, but in either case, they're not under proper control. So now we have this cleansing, this blotting out spoken of. And who was with Moses when he said, whoever's with God, come stand by me? It was his own tribe of Levi, the tribe that was going to be taking up the mantle of caring for the tabernacle and later the temple and administering God's word and the sacrifices. So the task was there, cut down those, took part, no matter who. Could be brother, close relative, close friend. And then he tells, after that is all done, he says, dedicate yourselves today to the Lord. This cleansing of Israel was the destruction or total, complete, and eternal banishment of those who had stood against God for a false god. Then Moses seeks God's blessing on him, those who had not been destroyed. And he goes back to God. He says, I'm going to go back up to God and see if I can't get atonement for you. He asks God to forgive them. And all of this is in chapter 32, 25 through 35. He asks God to forgive him. And he also, and this is the, as far as I can tell, and this is the first mention of God's book. He says, he offers basically to exchange his name in that book for their forgiveness. He's that adamant about wanting Israel to be forgiven. God's answer is that whoever sinned, they're going to be blotted out of that book. And he tells him, now you lead them. I'm going to keep my distance. You lead them. I'll send my angel before you, and I will punish those. I will punish this people. But that's for what they did with the calf. But I'm not going to be among you anymore. I'm not going to be a part of this. Only my angel. So now we move on into chapter 33, the first four verses. It's time to leave Sinai. God commands to Moses that it's time to go. He says, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it. Now this is an acquiescence of God, saying after Moses' discussion with him, pleading with him, he at first wanted to destroy them all. Now he says, okay, you take them, you lead them up there. And I did promise, yes I did, so I will follow through with that promise. That an angel would go before them, God would not be among them, lest he destroy them for their obstinance. They're no longer to wear their ornaments. Why does God not want them to wear their ornaments anymore? Well, that's what they used to make this golden calf. Where did those ornaments come from? Came from the Egyptians. Why? God promised them, I'm going to make those Egyptians give you all of their plunder. And that way I'm going to plunder Egypt. It's going to be for you. God told them, not going to wear those things anymore. Take them off. And they did, and they never wore them again. What God had blessed them with had been used for evil purposes. Is there a lesson in that for us? Is it possible for us to take something that God has blessed us with and use it for wrong? The first thing that kind of pops into mind, were you going to?
I was just going to say sometimes it's hard to handle prosperity.
Yeah. It especially sudden, unearned prosperity. You see some of these lottery winners just absolutely go nuts with all their money, and shortly thereafter they no longer have their money. But, yes, the first thing popped into my mind was a bully, you know, some guy that's blessed with great stature, strength, reflexes, and all at once he owns lunch money from all the weaker ones in the school. Using a blessing for evil. And there are more subtle ways to do that, to misuse God's blessings. But yes, it's something that we need to guard ourselves against. God blessing us with something and us not being careful to use that for the betterment of our souls and the souls of others. So now, with this non-presence of God in their Moses decides it's time to move the tent of meeting because I need to meet with God. and he's not going to be among the people. So he moves that tent out away from the camp. And we're looking for 33 verses 7 through 11. So everyone had someone watching. There was this Moses watch thing that went on. Everybody's got someone watching Moses. When Moses goes out of the main camp, out to the periphery where the tent of meeting had been moved, they would watch, and if he went in and they saw that pillar of cloud come down onto the tent, then everyone gathered at the entries of their own tents, and they worshiped there. They could not go to that tent of meeting because God would, I would imagine, depart at that point, did not want to tolerate their presence. Kind of hard to imagine that kind of situation, having to watch from a distance when God's presence had been in the middle of the camp previously. And here we see also a picture of the loyalty and watchfulness of Joshua. Joshua is destined to be a great leader among the Israelites, and here we see one of the reasons why. He was very closely attached to Moses, very loyal to Moses, and by extension, loyal to God. So let's move down to verses 12 through 23, I'm sorry, 25 of chapter 33. And here's something that Moses wants greatly. And this, when we discuss this, remember Moses at the burning bush. I'm not the man. Who am I to do this? I can't do this. I don't have what it takes to do this. Moses asked for favor in God's sight. He's already got favor in God's sight. In fact, God told him that he had favor in his sight, but he says, I want favor in your sight. He knows that favor in God's sight is not just a one-time thing. It's a continual thing. Moses wants to know God's ways. He says, by knowing your ways, I can know how to find favor in your sight. How do you get to know someone? How do you get to know a person better? You spend time with that person. You talk with that person. You learn what you can about that person. This is Moses. He wants to spend time with God. He wants to know God's ways. He wants to talk with God. And that, I think, is a good lesson for us. We want to know God. We want to know God's ways. We need to spend time with God. We need to converse with God, pray to him, and read his word. That's a two-way communication. Moses wants also, once he's got this far, he wants also to see God's glory. And shouldn't we all? God consents. He said he's going to reveal himself, but not his face. That comes for much later, of course. Well, it looks like we are at the end of the lesson, about time for the young ones to come on in and take their place with us and the next worship service to begin. So we will get on into hopefully the very end of Exodus next week. We hope you enjoy the study.